Chapter 50. There, as an embodied faction, but everywhere as an intangible influence. The equitafauna of his enemies had pervaded every fiber of the state. The mist of anguish lifted, he saw himself alone among ruins. For a moment, Fulvia's glowing faith had hung between him and a final vision of the truth. And as his convictions weakened, he had replaced them with an immense pity, an all-sufficing hope. Sentimental verbiage. He saw it clearly now. He had been the dupe of the old word jugglery which was forever confounding fact and fancy in men's minds. For it was essentially an age of words. The world was drunk with them, as it had once been drunk with action, and the former was the deadlier drug of the two. He looked about him languidly, letting the facts of life filter slowly through his faculties. The sources of energy were so benumbed in him that he felt like a man whom long disease had reduced to helplessness, and who must laboriously begin his bodily education again. Hate was the only passion which survived, and that was but a deafened transit of emotion coiled in his nature's depths. Sickness at last brought its obliteration. He sank into gulfs of weakness and oblivion, and when the rise of the tide floated him back to life, it was to a life as faint and colorless as infancy. Colorless too were the boundaries on which he looked out. The narrow enclosure of white walls, opening on a slit of pale spring landscape. His hands lay before him, white and helpless on the white coverlet of his bed. He raised his eyes and saw the crucis at his side. Then he began to remember. There had been preceding intervals of consciousness, and in one of them, in answer perhaps to some vaguely uttered wish for light and air, he had been carried out of the palace and the city to the Benedictine monastery on its wooded knoll beyond the Piana. Then the veil had dropped again, and his spirit had wandered in a dim place of shades. There was a faint sweetness in coming back at last to familiar sights and sounds. They no longer hurt like pressure on an aching nerve. They seemed rather, now, the touch of a reassuring hand. As the contact with life became closer and more sustained, he began to watch himself curiously, wondering what instincts and habits of thought would survive his long mental death. It was with a bitter, almost pitiable disappointment that he found the old man growing again in him. Life, with a mocking hand, brought him the cast-off vesture of his past, and he felt himself gradually compressed again into the old passions and prejudices. Yet he wore them with a difference. They were a cramping garment, rather than a living sheath. He had brought back from his lonely voyagings a sense of estrangement deeper than any surface affinity with things. As his physical strength returned, and he was able to leave his room and walk through the long corridors to the outer air, he felt the old spell which the life of Monte Cassino had cast on him. The quiet garden, with its clumps of box and lavender between paths converging to the statue of Saint Benedict, the cloisters paved with the monks' nameless graves, the traces of devotional painting left here and there on the weather-beaten walls, like fragments of prayer in a world-worn mind. These formed a circle of tranquilizing influences in which he could gradually reacquire the habit of living. He had never deceived himself as to the cause of the riots. He knew from Gamba and Andriani that the liberals and the court, for once working in unison, had provoked the blind outburst of fanaticism which a rasher judgment might have ascribed to the clergy. The Dominicans, bigoted and eager for power, had been ready enough to serve such an end, and some of the begging orders had furnished the necessary points of contact with the people. But the movement was at bottom purely political, and represented the resistance of the privileged classes to any attack on their inherited rights. As such, he could no longer regard it as completely unreasonable. He was beginning to feel the social and political significance of those old restrictions and barriers against which his early zeal had tilted. Certainly in the ideal state the rights and obligations of the different classes would be more evenly adjusted. But the ideal state was a figment of the brain. The real one, as Chris and I had long ago pointed out, was the gradual and heterogeneous product of remote social conditions, wherein every seeming inconsistency had its roots in some bygone need, and the character of each class, with its special passions, ignorances and prejudices, was the sum total of influences so ingrained and inveterate that they had become a law of thought. All this, however, seemed rather matter for philosophic musing than for definite action. His predominant feeling was still that of remoteness from the immediate issues of life. The Siva indignatio had been succeeded by a great calm. The soothing influences of the monastic life had doubtless helped to tide him over the stormy passage of returning consciousness. His sensitiveness to these influences inclined him for the first time to consider them analytically. Hitherto he had regarded the church as a skillfully adjusted engine, the product of human passions scientifically combined to obtain the greatest sum of tangible results. Now he saw that he had never penetrated beneath the surface. For the church which grasped, contrived, calculated, struggled for temporal possessions and used material weapons against spiritual foes, this outer church was nothing more than the body, which, like any other animal body, had to care for its own gross needs, nourish, clothe, defend itself, fight for a footing among the material resistances of life, while the soul, the inner animating principle, might dwell aloof from all these things, in a clear medium of its own. To the soul of the church his daily life now brought him close. He felt it in the ordered beneficence of the great community, in the simplicity of its external life, and the richness and suavity of its inner relations. No alliance based on material interests, no love of power working toward a common end, could have created that harmony of thought and act which was reflected in every face about him. Each of these men seemed to have found out something, of which he was still ignorant. What it was, De Crucis tried to tell him as they paced the cloisters together, or sat in the warm stillness of the budding garden. At the first news of the Duke's illness, the Jesuit had hastened to Pianura. No companionship could have been so satisfying to Odo. De Crucis's mental attitude toward mankind might have been defined as an illuminated charity. To love men, or to understand them, is not as unusual as to do both together, and it was the intellectual acuteness of his friend's judgments that made their Christian amenity so seductive to Odo. The highest claim of Christianity, the Jesuit said one morning, as they sat on a worn stone bench at the end of the sunny vine walk, is that it has come nearer to solving the problem of men's relations to each other than any system invented by themselves. This, after all, is the secret principle of the Church's vitality. She gave a spiritual charter of equality to mankind long before the philosophers thought of giving them a material one. If, all the while, she has been fighting for dominion, arrogating to herself special privileges, struggling to preserve the old lines of social and legal demarcation, it has been because for nigh 2,000 years she has cherished in her breast the one free city of the spirit, because to guard its liberties she has had to defend and strengthen her own position. I do not ask you to consider whence comes this insight into the needs of man, this mysterious power over him. I ask you simply to confess them in their results. I am not of those who believe that God permits good to come to mankind through one channel only, and I doubt not that now, and in times past, the thinkers whom your highness follows have done much to raise the condition of their fellows. But I would have you observe that, where they have done so, it has been because, at bottom, their aims coincided with the Church's. The deeper you probe into her secret sources of power, the more you find there, in the germ if you will, but still potentially active, all those humanizing energies which work together for the lifting of the race. In her wisdom and her patience she may have seen fit to withhold their expression, to let them seek another outlet. But they are there, stored in her consciousness like the archetypes of the Platonists, in the universal mind. It is the knowledge of this, the sure knowledge of it, which creates the atmosphere of serenity that you feel about you. from the tilling of the vineyards, or the dressing of a beggar's sores, to the loftiest and most complicated intellectual labor imposed on him, each brother knows that his daily task is part of a great scheme of action, working ever from imperfection to perfection, from human incompleteness to the divine completion. This sense of being, not straws on a blind wind of chance, but units in an ordered force, gives to the humblest Christian an individual security and dignity which kings on their thrones might envy. But not only does the Church anticipate every tendency of mankind, alone of all powers she knows how to control and direct the passions she excites. This it is which makes her an auxiliary that no temporal prince can well despise. It is in this aspect that I would have your highness consider her. Do not underrate her power, because it seems based on the commoner instincts, rather than on the higher faculties of man. That is one of the sources of her strength. She can support her claims by reason and argument, but it is because her work, like that of her divine founder, lies chiefly among those who can neither reason nor argue, that she chooses to rest her appeal on the simplest and most universal emotions. As, in our towns, the streets are lit mainly by the tapers before the shrines of the saints, so the way of life would be dark to the great multitude of men, but for the light of faith burning within them. Meanwhile the shufflings of destiny had brought to Tresker the prize for which he waited. During the Duke's illness he had been appointed regent of Pianura, and his sovereign's reluctance to take up the cares of government had now left him for 6 months in authority. The day after the proclaiming of the Constitution Odo had withdrawn his signature from it, on the ground that the concessions it contained were inopportune. The functions of government went on again in the old way. The old abuses persisted, the old offenses were condoned. It was as though the apathy of the sovereign had been communicated to his people. Centuries of submission were in their blood, and for two generations there had been no warfare south of the Alps. For the moment men's minds were turned to the great events going forward in France. It had not yet occurred to the Italians that the recoil of these events might be felt among themselves. They were simply amused spectators, roused at last to the significance of the show, but never dreaming that they might soon be called from the wings to the footlights. To the Crucis, however, the possibility of such a call was already present, and it was he who pressed the Duke to return to his post. A deep reluctance held Odo back. He would have liked to linger on in the monastery, leading the tranquil, yet busy life of the monks, and trying to read the baffling riddle of its completeness. At that moment it seemed to him of vastly more importance to discover the exact nature of the soul, whether it was in fact a metaphysical entity, as these men believed, or a mere secretion of the brain, as he had been taught to think, than to go back and govern his people. For what mattered the rest, if he had been mistaken about the soul? With a start he realized that he was going as his cousin had gone, that this was but another form of the fatal lethargy that hung upon his race. An effort of the will drew him back to Pianura, and made him resume the semblance of authority, but it carried him no farther. Tresker ostensibly became prime minister, and in reality remained the head of the state. The Duke was present at the cabinet meetings, but took no part in the direction of affairs. His mind was lost in a maze of metaphysical speculations, and even he served him merely as some cunningly contrived toy with which to trick his leisure. His revocation of the charter had necessarily separated him from Gamba and the advanced liberals. He knew that the hunchback, ever scornful of expediency, charged him with disloyalty to the people, but such charges could no longer wound. The events following the Duke's birthday had served to crystallize the schemes of the little liberal group, and they now formed a campaign of active opposition to the government, attacking it by means of pamphlets and lampoons, and by such public speaking as the police allowed. The new professors of the university, ardently in sympathy with the constitutional movement, used their lectures as means of political teaching, and the old stronghold of dogma became the center of destructive criticism. But as yet these ideas formed but a single live point in the general numbness. 2 years passed in this way. North of the Alps, all Europe was convulsed, while Italy was still but a sleeper who tosses in his sleep. In the two Sicilies, the arrogance and perfidy of the government gave a few martyrs to the cause, and in Bologna there was a brief revolutionary outbreak. But for the most part the Italian states were sinking into inanition. Venice, by recalling her fleet from Greece, let fall the dominion of the sea. 20 years earlier Genoa had basely yielded Corsica to France. The Pope condemned the French for their outrages on religion, and his subjects murdered Basseville, the agent of the new republic. The sympathies and impulses of the various states were as contradictory as they were ineffectual. Meanwhile, in France, Europe was trying to solve at a stroke the problems of a thousand years. All the repressed passions which civilization had sought, however imperfectly, to curb, stalked abroad destructive as flood and fire. The great generation of the encyclopedists had passed away, and the teachings of Rousseau had prevailed over those of Montesquieu and Voltaire. The sober sense of the economists was swept aside by the sound and fury of the demagogues, and France was become a very Babel of tongues. The old malady of words had swept over the world like a pestilence. To the little Italian courts, still dozing in fancied security under the wing of Bourbon and Habsburg suzerains, these rumors were borne by the wild flight of émigrés, dead leaves loosened by the first blast of the storm. Month by month they poured across the Alps in ever-increasing numbers, bringing confused contradictory tales of anarchy and outrage. Among those whom chance thus carried to Pianura were certain familiars of the Duke's earlier life, the Count Alfieri and his royal mistress, flying from Paris, and arriving breathless with the tale of their private injuries. To the poet of revolt this sudden realization of his doctrine seemed in fact a purely personal outrage. It was as though a man writing an epic poem on an earthquake should suddenly find himself engulfed. To Alfieri the downfall of the French monarchy and the triumph of democratic ideas meant simply that his French investments had shrunk to nothing, and that he, the greatest poet of the age, had been obliged, at an immense sacrifice of personal dignity, to plead with a drunken mob for leave to escape from Paris. To the wider aspect of the tragic farce, as he called it, his eyes remained obstinately closed. He viewed the whole revolutionary movement as a conspiracy against his comfort, and boasted that during his enforced residence in France he had not so much as exchanged a word with one of the wretched slaves, instigators of false liberty, who, by trying to put into action the principles taught in his previous works, had so grievously interfered with the composition of fresh masterpieces. The royal pretensions of the Countess of Albany pretensions affirmed, rather than abated as the tide of revolution rose made it impossible that she should be received at the court of Pianura, but the Duke found a mild entertainment in Alfieri's company. The poet's revulsion of feeling seemed to Odo like the ironic laughter of the fates. His thoughts returned to the midnight meetings of the honeybees, and to the first vision of that face which men had lain down their lives to see. Men had looked on that face since then, and its horror was reflected in their own. Other fugitives to Pianura brought another impression of events, that comic note which life, the supreme dramatic artist, never omits from her tragedies. These were the Duke's old friend the Marquis de Kervoland, fleeing from his chateau as the peasants put the torch to it, and arriving in Pianura destitute, gouty and middle-aged, but imperturbable and epigrammatic as ever. With him came his Marquise, a dark-eyed lady, stout to unwieldiness and much given to devotion, in whom it was whispered, though he introduced her as the daughter of a Venetian senator, that a reminiscent eye might still detect the outline of the gracephilist Columban who had ever flitted across the Italian stage. These visitors were lodged by the Duke's kindness in the Palazzo Cerveno, near the Ducal residence. And though the ladies of Pianura were inclined to look askance on the Marquise's genealogy, yet his Highness's condescension, and her own edifying piety, had soon allayed these scruples, and the salon of Madame de Kiervoland became the rival of Madame d'Albany's. It was, in fact, the more entertaining of the two. For, in spite of his lady's austere views, the Marquis retained that gift of social flexibility that was already becoming the tradition of a happier day. To the Marquis, indeed, the revolution was execrable, not so much because of the hardships it inflicted, as because it was the forerunner of social dissolution, the breaking up of the regime which had made manners the highest morality, and conversation the chief end of man. He could have lived gaily on a crust in good company, and amid smiling faces, but the social deficiencies of Pianura were more difficult to endure than any material privation. In Italy, as the Marquis had more than once remarked, people loved, gambled, wrote poetry, and patronized the arts. But, alas, they did not converse. Kiervoland could not conceal from His Highness that there was no conversation in Pianura. But he did his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.